Yeah, it's called Buffy Flowing Spike. Hey, it's a hot and cold Saturday morning. St. Patrick's Day weekend. St. Patrick's Day Eve is what it is. Coming from the Italo-Hungarian host of the radio program this morning. Happy St. Patrick's Day. That was the Chieftains with Van Morrison. A song called Buffy Flow and Spike. I think Van Morrison wrote it. I'm not sure, but what do I know? Good one. Good one. So we will have tunes this morning on St. Patrick's Day Eve with a slight Irish tilt to them. Years ago, many years ago, too far ago, there's people out there who might be listening who were younger than, who were not born when I did this. I wound up in Northern Ireland, in Bangor, Northern Ireland. We had trade between Bangor, Northern Ireland and Bangor, Maine, bringing in solar stuff. And I went there on a, I guess they call it a trade mission, with Bob Ziegler, who is, used to be the airport manager and has a very smart, extraordinarily capable person, great asset to Eastern Maine. Went with him to Northern Ireland. And this Bob's just a great guy to know and fun to travel with. And I hadn't been, excuse me, overseas before. So we met with the, I think it was the British, somebody from the British consulate. We met at the British Air first class waiting room. Didn't wait with the mere peons. And so we're hobnobbing with this guy. Bob realizes he forgot his passport. Now, the kind of guy he is, he knows everybody. We were able to get into the UK with him not having a passport because, and I'm thinking now, I have no clue, you know, going through all the different airports and stuff and what one has to do. And that was back when the troubles were still going on in Northern Ireland. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, I can't travel alone to Northern Ireland. I don't know where I'm going. But they let him in. And we had a great visit. It was unproductive business wise, but the British government assigned us a driver, and I was really embarrassed because I did not feel like we were a captain of industry coming from Bangor, Maine. But it was just delightful, and it truly is green. It was February, I think, when we went, and it was green. The water fountains were going in the middle of winter. It was something else. So, and appreciate that memory with Bob. And I was laden with guilt the whole time because my wife's grandparents are from the area we were in. She had a relative living in Bangor, Northern Ireland, and here I am. You know what connection do I have with Bangor, Northern Ireland? We were doing business with them. No other connection. But it was delightful. And aside from feeling guilty, I was only there 2 days. It was an interesting visit. And checking in ahead of us, we stayed at the Culloden. You can Google it, Culloden in Belfast, Northern Ireland. It's a castle. And checking in ahead of us is this little short guy. And he's got a woman on each arm, right? And I hear the voice. Now, this is in the 1980s. And I hear this voice, and I recognize this voice. It was Jackie Stewart, the race car driver, checking in the same place. Anyway, so it goes. I thought just came to my mind. It's St. Patrick's Day weekend. That's not St. Patrick's Day stuff, but it's as close as I'm going to get on Saturday mornings. And what a Saturday morning this is, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, kids of all ages. There's no ice on the roads. It's not snowing. It's not sleeting. It's above freezing. So the fog was wicked this morning driving up because now we had to do the stupid thing with the clocks, turning the clocks ahead. It's dark out, and it was foggy. I want to tell you, Mr. Man, we had some fog down all the way up pretty much into Bangor. But it's daylight now, so who cares, right? Speaking of ice, the ice is out in my shop, my new shop. I've got the radiant floor running, been melting ice all week. Had a couple of miscues along the way, I didn't have the oil burner running for about a day and a half. And I spoke the young woman who works here at the studio, Mandy Exley, who is the production person extraordinaire. Her dad, Bob, is an oil burner guy, and I'm on his cell phone. He's on my cell phone, so when I call him, he knows who it is. And I called him about troubleshooting, and it turned out I had air in a air in the oil line, and I changed some things around. I thought I had bled it adequately, and I did it, in case you're listening, Bob. And I was trying to diagnose over the phone. And one thing I have never done with an oil burner, because usually I would just call Bob when we had a problem, but he's in Bangor, so I'm down on the coast, so it wasn't that easy to break him away from what he's doing. And so I was trying to just sort it out myself. And one of the things I did was check the transformer. And I've never done this, but the to test the transformer, you you take a screwdriver, you open it up. You know, you don't have the burner running, but you have it with power to the transformer that is for the igniter, and put a screwdriver across. And, man, I want to tell you, that's a big spark that makes. That's a whole new thing for me. I mean, making big sparks and not getting a shock is kind of an exciting thing for me to do. So I don't have much in my life. I mean, you know, if I can make things spark, that's always fun. And this is high voltage spark, so it's a big one. So I got to fool around with that for a day or so, thinking I had a bad electrode after I saw the transformers okay. I found the electrodes were okay, and then I figured out the air thing. So it was all good in the end. And the heat is running, and now we're in the process. The next step is to dry the floor, and I'm going to have that floor dry. I want to tell you, Mr. Mann, it is going to be dried off within a day or two. But we're going to take a break here. When we come back, we will take some phone calls at 1-800-966-1039. We got a text line up and running. Boy, I tell you, you know, it's just a technological wonder, this radio station. 601-207-4478 is the phone number for the it's the text number line. So hang with us. It's St. Patrick's Day Eve, and that sounds like Irish stuff, don't it? Yeah, it kind of is. And we're back. It's 8:20. It's hot and cold on Saturday morning. A little bit of Fairport Convention. When's the last time you heard them, huh? It's been a while. Anyway, my wife, as I said, is basically half, probably more than half Irish. But when she was a kid, and this was the thread going, and my wife and I are basically the same age. She's a couple months older than me. But being a child of the 50s, what was the thing in the 50s where you had, if you were Irish, on St. Patrick's Day, you would get your posterior painted green? And myself, being raised by an Italian mother, I was to go to church and get my posterior painted red. And it was very upsetting. No wonder I do radio. Anyway, our phone number is 1-800-966-1039 is the phone number, and there's the phone. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Yeah, I had a question. I got a camper, and I got plywood floors there. They're about rotten out. Have you ever heard of a plastic subfloor?
Yes and no. They use a high-density foam in boats for structural purposes. Unfortunately, it's not cheap. Regular plastic tends to be a little too flexible, and if it gets if you get into some thickness to, you know, make it more rigid, it gets really heavy. The density is kind of high, so okay. It's not ideal. I would suggest, I always thought, well, gee, you use pressure treated. The dilemma with pressure treated is if you're mating it to steel framing, which you're apt to be, it's treated with copper, and the copper tends to make the steel rust. So you either have to buffer it with something like maybe ice and water shield, and even then I'm kind of wondering if it's viable. But you could check, you can Google it, structural foam. Hamilton Marine sells it. It ain't cheap, but if you don't need a lot, it might be a good alternative.
Yeah, I figured I'd be paying a little more, you know, through my nose, but it's a small space, you know, it's only a 28 foot camper, so
yeah, it might work,
you know. And okay, so high structural foam. Okay, that's great. I appreciate that.
Okay, you're welcome. Okay, bye bye. Yeah, and Hamilton Marine, I don't know if they stock it, but I know it's in their catalog. I just got their catalog last week, and I just, you know, I'm not a boat guy. I've been around boats because we had a boat builder next door to us for a while, and I would just go over there and look at what they were doing and just want to crawl around inside the boat and look at all the systems and stuff, because it's different, obviously, than a, it's a microcosm of a house, but it floats. And has all the, it has to have all the same functioning systems, plus has to be able to move around. And so they have some pretty interesting stuff. Let's see. What else we got here? This I've had in my shop for probably 3 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, a Toyota Highlander hybrid that needed a radiator. And I was told it was a bit of a job and it was going to be expensive. So I said, well, I'll do it to save on the cost. Budgets are tight this time of year. So I dug into it and kept digging and digging and digging and left it. I did, you know, I got, you know, I'd go at, and it was cold in my shop. And, you know, I said, well, when the weather gets a little warmer, I'll go do it. Well, the weather got warmer this week, so I said, okay. You know, I take off a couple pieces and try to remember how I'm going to put it back together. So finally, excuse me, I was down to the nitty-gritty. I almost have it completely apart. And Thursday, I decided was the day I'm going to do this. The new radiator had come in. It's been sitting there forever, just waiting for somebody to drop something on it. But it didn't happen. So I fought. And I mustered all my cognitive skills, got the radiator out of the car. And I thought, well, now the new one's going to be a pip to get back in. But it actually went in really well, with one exception. And if you've worked on cars, maybe you've dealt with this. All cars have spring-loaded hose clamps. You know, there's a springy hose clamp, not the screw kind. And they're actually ideal for cars because they expand and contract, and they do a good job. But they can be just, A, if you don't have the right tool, they can be hard to work with. And I think even with the right tool, they could be hard to work with. And I had one on the bottom that was hard to get to. I got it off the hose okay, got the radiator out, but I went to put it back and it just was fighting me. And I borrowed the proper pliers to release the clamp and it still fought me. So at some point after about a half hour of using language I wouldn't use around my mother, I said, I'm going to buy a regular hose clamp that screws in place. And so I go to the hardware store, spend the big bucks, go to the hardware store. So I want it now. And I measure the outside diameter of the clamp. You know, I take it out, I measure it, and I opened it up a little bit, you know, so it's wider. Make sure I get the right, I don't want to get one too small. And I get the thing, and it's too small. I said, okay, time to go home. And I called my friends at B&L and said, deliver me. I got 1 3/4, needed 2 inch. Bring me 2 of them. I want a spare. And put it together, finished putting it back together. You know, if you work on cars in 2019, and I'm talking cars that might be within the past 15 years, usually what appears to be the bumper, which is just a plastic cover, has to be removed for anything like this. I started out with the bumper cover on, finally had to take it off. And if you work on cars, this is a regular thing. You take that whole front end cover off. Then the bumper had to come off because I needed extra room. So it got to be quite an enterprise, but it's all back together. And it worked. Didn't leak. Just to be safe, I put a piece of cardboard underneath it after I filled it. I just want to watch. I'm not putting the bumper cover back on. I make sure there ain't no drips, and there were no drips. So I was very, very pleasantly surprised by that I was able to accomplish something that has taken weeks. It was a couple hours. It was probably a 4-hour job all the way around, you know, taking it apart, putting it back together. No directions. I just kind of dug into it. I've been through enough of these. Well, Toyotas generally tend to be put together very similarly. So, speaking of complicated pains in the posterior, painted green or red or blue or whatever. I finished putting together our first garage door in the new shop. And I haven't, the garage door is in place on the inside of the building. And you'd have to see the construction to understand how I pulled it off. But the building is still covered on the outside with steel. And the plan is once the garage door is finished, I will lift it up onto, you know, so it's overhead. And I will take my my recip saw and my, I have sheet metal cutters. And I will cut the hole in the side of the building. Right now I have total security. I don't have to worry about, well, the door isn't done. I'll finish the door. I can literally finish the door inside the building and then cut the hole and actually have a functioning garage door. That is going to happen maybe this weekend, beginning of the week. So if you've been watching the project and see nothing changing on the outside, everything has been happening on the inside pretty much. And the garage door is there. I've got the springs. I've got pulleys. I've got I could have done a torsion bar spring, but I've got the old-fashioned springs. I just, it was just easier for me mentally. It doesn't take much to put me off kilter. So you'll see. And it may even work. I've done garage doors in the past. I'm in awe of watching people who do garage doors for a living, like our friends at PDQ Door. We did a TV show with them years ago, and they banged out three doors in a garage that we were doing at the time and did a fantastic job. So it was kind of amazing to see somebody who really knows what they're doing as opposed to myself who just kind of makes believe or muddles his way through. Maybe that's the better word. Hey, we're going to take a break. It's 8:30 straight up. Phone number is 1-800-966-1039. We got a text line, which is 601-207-4478. It's hot and cold. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hey, we're back. It's 8:36. Hot and cold Saturday morning, St. Patrick's Day Eve. Phone number is 1-800-966-1039. We got a text line, 601-207-4478. And just want to tell you about my friend Alan over at General Appliance in Brewer. If you're looking for appliance parts or service, he's on Center Street in Brewer, over where Perkins Appliance used to be. He owns Perkins Appliance, even though his name is not Perkins. And he is right there to... sell you new appliances, sell you parts, help you fix your own refrigerator, freezer, washer, dryer, stove, whatever. Or he'll fix it for you. 989-4341 is the magic number to call for General Appliance and Brewer, Perkins Appliance and Brewer, same place. And Alan is at both. And the 989-4341, if you remember that number, you're doing well because you'll need it someday. And when you do, you're going to say, what was that number, Tom? Said, well, it's easy. It's 989-4341. So be sure to write that down somewhere. It's in the phone book, too. And I bet if you Googled it, it's right there. What a time in which we live, boys and girls. I tell you what. Let's see. What else we got? I got a text. Am I going to play any Irish Rovers? I don't know. I don't know. I wasn't a huge Irish Rovers fan. They were a little too folksy for me. American folksy, not true Irish folk, but I'll see. If I find something that tickles my fancy, it'll get out there. So my wife says to me last night, we were talking about getting things done at the house, and she never she doesn't browbeat me or hit me over the head or anything, but I had painted back in December, and there are areas I missed because I did a lot of painting at night, and I used paint that I was not happy with that always requires two coats, even though you're covering not crazy colors. It takes two coats. So she says, well, I find the spots and then I forget where they are. You're not around. And so I said, well, look, let me get your roll of masking tape, you know, painter's tape. You can mark where the spots are, and then I can, if the spirit moves me at 9 o'clock at night, which for some reason it often does, I go do some touch up. So that was one. So we were discussing other household things that I could do, you know, and she said, she said, "Well, you're all done with the heat, right?" I said, "No, I haven't done it yet." Now, I have said on this radio program, I'm going to do the heat over at my house. But it was the middle of winter, and as game as I am with all the other stuff going on, undoing the heating system in my house wasn't high on my list of things that I thought I should do, you know, when it was going down to single numbers every night. But now that I've got the heat running in the shop, it seemed, and it's comparatively warm outside. The house stays warm. I mean, any day the sun is out, I come home. I basically have taken to, even when it was cold, it was sunny out, I just turn off the heat completely when I left the house in the morning. I'd be back maybe 10 hours later, and it's 70. If it's sunny, it's 73, 74 degrees in the house. So this is why we insulate, at least the way I do. So now that we're into the maybe milder time of year, slightly milder time of year, I don't feel quite so nervous about undoing everything, which I've got to find my drawings. What was I going to do? Oh, do I want to change any of this now? I mean, I've got all the stuff laid out on the floor in the basement. It sat there for a month and a half probably waiting. And some of the tools have had to leave the house because I needed them for hooking up heat at the shop. But the shop heat is basically hooked up at this point. So I can start to ferry everything back and maybe make some sense out of that. I've been wiring, I think I mentioned last week, I've been putting in conduit and wiring everything up, and ran out of electrical boxes. So I had to pick up more this morning, and I'm really getting into wiring and conduit. I've always kind of found it entertaining to do, just because it's all at the surface. If you've ever been in an old house, if you've renovated an old house yourself, and you got to the level of doing wiring, you know, even if you just put it in an outlet or two, you know what a hassle it is to deal with an old house. And if it's a really old house that maybe was heated with coal sometime in the murky past, and you start digging into walls and attics, you are black with dusty, coal-type, dusty, dirt, messy. Just, it's kind of like working on a really greasy car almost, except it's sooty and drier as opposed to greasy and wet. But it's the same. Right now I'm greasy and wet when I'm doing projects, but in the past, when I've worked on old houses, if you're not gutting the walls and you're rooting around trying to get a wire up through, you know, without cutting big holes in the building, there's always filth there. And this is why electricians make a lot of money, because they have to, A, have the experience to be able to do this with minimal impact on your building, and B, they know it's going to be miserable work. Years ago, I was doing when I lived in Bangor, we had a hallway with a spiral staircase and had lights on the first floor. I wanted to put a three-way switch upstairs, downstairs, so either way we could turn out, you don't have to run downstairs, turn out the light, and then we'd come back up in the dark. So I'm just going to run an outlet. A switch. While I'm there, I'll put an outlet in too. And what I did was it had tall baseboards, maybe I'm measuring with my fingers here, maybe 7-8 inches tall. And it was probably even 8-quarter. It wasn't even 5-quarter. It was 6-quarter. It was beefy stuff. So I take off the piece of baseboard. I take off the trim. So the height of that whole deal was almost 10 inches. And down, obviously, at the floor. So it gave me the opportunity to cut a hole in the wall for snaking wiring up through. So I cut this hole in the wall down at the baseboard. And this was a wall that was maybe a foot wide. It wasn't very wide. And, you know, I'm going to put a light switch. It's no big deal. I cut the hole in the baseboard, and I reach in there, and there is something there. Now, as I've done this old house over, which was belonged to a lumber baron kind of guy. It was a big house. It was on Broadway, in the fancy part of Broadway. Anytime I dug into a wall cavity or a floor cavity, like in the attic, I had a flashlight and a mirror just to see if there was anything hidden in between the floors. And I didn't do that here because I was just running a wire and I figured what could be there. So I reach in and there's something there. And I pull it out and it is a desiccated, dried out rat. Intact. How's breakfast going? And they're like, oh, man. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, electricians do make a lot of money and they deserve it. It was in the wall in the second floor of the house, and it must have fallen down. It must have been in the attic, and it was balloon framed house. A lot of the framing was balloon framed. So if you're up in the attic and you open the floor at the right spot, you could look down at least into the second floor, if not the first floor. And when we cellulosed the attic, which we did, you know, it was no insulation in the whole house. We put cellulose in the attic. I had piles of cellulose in the basement where it had fallen down through because I'd missed a spot where it was open. So there were critters, apparently, that made their way round and round in the building. It was a good time. Our phone number is 1-800-966-1039. Our text line is 601-207-4478. I had a somebody – I did some of the cellulose work myself, but I had somebody come and do the attic. And when I was prepping, tearing up floorboards and stuff in the attic to cellulose it, I found two skeletons that were from dead bats probably 100 years ago. And I left them. I don't have to clean them up. There's nothing left, just bones. I'll leave it for somebody to look at. And the person who was doing the insulation was not impressed. When they came to that point in the attic. So, what else? That's pretty much it. I guess I'm done with the radio show. We got no phone calls. We got no text messages on the day before. Now, you're not celebrating St. Patrick's Day already. I know that for a fact. I know you are not that kind of person. But at 8:46 on a Saturday morning, celebrating St. Patrick's Day, that's not right. But our phone number again, 1-800-966-1039. The text line is 601-207-4478. What else I got? We picked up some interesting cars. We picked up another Tacoma pickup this week. An 04. You know, I'm getting into old Tacoma pickups. I've got an 04 I picked up maybe a month ago that we have parts coming for, and that's going to get turned around the next week or so. And I picked up another 04 this past week with 134,000 miles on. Now, here's the thing. The first one's got 279,000 miles. Both trucks have new frames, new Toyota frames under them. And they both run good. I mean, I've seen this so many times with these things. They run about the same. Well, the higher mile one doesn't run about the same because it has these big, stupid, knobby tires and it needs exhaust work. But it... running gear wise, it's exactly the same. So I'm going to get those knocked out hopefully in the next week or so. So keep an eye if you're looking for a Tacoma. I got them. And that's a dial tone, so we don't have to worry about that, do we? Let's try that again. 1-800-966-1039 is the number to call. Oh, and the other thing I got, that is even more important, you know, Tacomas, who cares? I got a plug-in Prius this week. 2013 plug-in Prius is coming up to Tom's Land of Priuses, so I'm looking forward to this. First plug-in Prius we've ever gotten, and that's going to be a fun project. It doesn't need anything, but it needs a little bit of love. They all do. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine. And whoa, what's going on here? Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Hey, Tom. Just had a Bradford White hot water heater put in.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could just give some advice on the different modes and if I keep that in a hybrid mode or a heat pump only mode with my forced hot air cellar.
Make
sure that it doesn't cool off too much.
You know, it's pretty straightforward stuff. I would start out with running the heat pump just in heat pump mode. And this time of year, especially where it's hot air heat, you might find that it may cool the space down too much. You're going to find that out in the first day. So start it out that way and see how cool the basement gets. If it's uncomfortably cool, then flip it over to hybrid mode, which hybrid mode is going to alternate. It'll function between a heat pump and electric. In terms of usage, most folks I find have been able to just work with the heat pump and never use backup. And obviously that's more efficient. The wild card is, does it make the basement too cold? This time of year, it might do that. excuse me. It's going to scavenge heat off your hot air heating system. So that may, I think there's still some advantage in doing that and running it in pure heat pump mode this time of year. But the only consideration I would have in not running in hybrid mode is to, is the space getting too cool? And you'll find that out probably in a half day. So if the usage, the recovery time is probably twice as long as the electric would be using the heat pump. This time of year may be a shade longer because it may be a little cooler in the basement than normal. But I would not hesitate to just run it in pure heat pump. See what happens. If you're not happy, somebody hollers at you. It happens. Put it over in hybrid, and then it'll work fine. And minimize the inconvenience of having the basement be too cool this time of year. Come springtime, official springtime, which is, what is that? Got to get Rick's thing over here. Spring starts on Wednesday. Well, Wednesday, you'll be all set. All right, back to the phones, line two. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine. Hello?
Good morning, Dick. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Finally, we get some weather, huh?
Yeah.
Holy mackerel. Hey, you're talking about critters. A serious problem, critters. What about critter-proofing a house? Putting sheet metal where the sills are. And so because that's where they get in. They get in right under the shingles near the sill, and you just can't stop them. They just sneak up through there. I mean, you can poison them to death, but after a while, that's not healthy for anybody having poison around the house.
Yeah, well, the
sheet metal, when you're building the house, sheet metal under the eaves and up maybe 2 or 3 feet around the whole house.
Yeah, I don't think you need to go to that extreme. I think you could, if it's new construction, it's probably going to be tight. And if you've got wood barriers there, they're not going to get in. It's older buildings or someplace where somebody is not, I guess, what I would call a really good carpenter, where there's going to be voids, and the voids are going to, a critter will find access in through those voids. There's no doubt about it. So, a layer of foam is not adequate. Somebody will get through. Anything is going to chew through the foam if they want to. I think pressure-treated lumber is adequate, and I don't think you need to cover the bottom 3 feet because they just don't get in there. But if there's a hole somewhere, a gap in the framing that is not covered with wood, it's much more likely they're going to get in. My experience in old buildings, this building that I had was riddled with holes, and it wasn't. It wasn't deliberate. It was just the way they built the building. There were holes everywhere. And, of course, as it got older and things shrank, there were cracks that opened up. There might have been something that rotted a little bit, and I'll never forget. I had a space at an eave where the front gable end eave met the fascia board in the front of the house. There was a hole there, and there would be gray squirrels looking out the hole at me. And I went up there. First time I did it, I foamed it. And that lasted about a week. And the squirrels just chewed right through. And I went back up there. And the second time I did it, I fiberglassed it. And I used long strand fiberglass. And I put a heavy layer. I could have used metal, but I wanted to. It had curves and details to it that I wanted to protect. So that worked. there were still other areas where there were holes, and everyone I could find, I either flashed, because a lot of them were on the roof. You know, in older houses in particular, you know, they were not as concerned about sealing things up real tight as they were just making sure it shed water. And one of the things I thought was interesting before we insulated was there was a cistern in the attic and pipes that went down through the house, and there was enough heat loss in that house, nothing ever froze. There wasn't a drop of insulation anywhere because everything was wide open. So heat just billowed out of this building, and this whole thing I was talking about, the black sooty stuff that you find, that was just going right up through the, but it was balloon framed house. And that the whole structure was a giant chimney. And of course, this giant chimney was also a, the fact it was a chimney meant it was open at the bottom enough and open at the top enough that it could convect air up through, which kept the pipes from freezing. But it was also the pathway for multiple critters to get through. I don't think it's as critical as it was or is an old house. It's critical in old houses. I think a new house, well built, it's not an issue as long as you're paying attention to those details. I don't think the metal is imperative. There's places you flash. Yes, absolutely. Other places you don't. We got to take a break, though. It is top of the hour again. It is top of the hour, period. We'll be back in a bit. It's hot and cold on Saturday morning. Write down the numbers for next hour. 1-800-966-1039 is the phone number. Text line is 601-207-4478. And I guess we're going to play some Irish music again. This is kind of Irish. That sounds Irish. Bluegrass music is Irish music, you know. Irish, Scottish. That's Irish on St. Patrick's Day. Okay, we're back. It's 9:06 here at the Voice of Maine. It's hot and cold. Good morning again. I'm Tom. St. Patrick's Day Eve. So we're getting loaded up on Irish music is what we're doing. Chieftains in the background. It's only 17 minutes long. We could play that, right? No? I'm getting the look from the management. They're hitting me with a stick. All right. excuse me. Good stuff. You can't not love the Chieftains. And way back, this goes back early in my radio career. The first talk station, I mean real talk station, like this place, even more so than this place, was actually an AM station that I landed on along with a bunch of other people. And then we all migrated over here, of which I'm the only remaining original. That's what I am. I'm original. They used to have Larry King. Larry King did a radio show in addition to the TV show, and he had on Patty. Is it Patty O'Donnell from the Chieftains? The head guy. And I got to call in and talk to Patty on St. Patrick's Day. I tell you what, that was cool. Just and it comes through the radio. The guy is just so easygoing, low key. It was good. And Larry King went. Yeah, the hometown of Stephen King. Yes, Larry, we knew that. Thank you. Anyway, let's go back to the phones at 1-800-966-1039. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Morning, Tom.
Hey.
Hey. In past shows, you've talked about a business you have with a partner with lithium batteries. And I was wondering if it's something that's online, you do business to business or anybody? Or
We will sell to anybody. What's happened in the I have it listed on the electric car website, and we have a variety of batteries, of which I'm not sure what we have right now, because the ones that we had that were apparently most desirable were packs from Chrysler Pacifica Hybrids.
Yeah,
and I got contacted by a guy on the West Coast who wanted some for his project. And he shared my information with a company on the West Coast that I've seen on TV doing $100,000 conversions. You know, that somebody with a lot of money says, yep. You know what? I got grandpa's old 1949 Ford truck. I want it all electric. And these guys do, they completely renovate the truck and then put an electric drivetrain in. And it's just amazing what they do. And so this guy called me, and he wants all the Pacifica packs we have. He says, I'll buy everything you can get. So we're a little up in the air in term, and I'm going to find out next week where we are, because my partner has been at the place where we get all our stuff from. We do have other ones. We had a couple of cells that I have been selling locally. One is called a V41. It's a cylindrical cell that's 41 amp hours and 3.7 volts, and made by Johnson Controls and some other companies. They partner together. And a lot of those have gone. I sold a bunch to a fellow who's converting his off-grid solar system, completely off the grid, converting from lead-acid batteries to these. He's been very happy with them. We also, and I think we're pretty much cleaned out on those right now, but we do have V6s, which are 6-amp-hour versions of the battery, and apparently we've got a lot of those. The catch is a lot more wiring involved because you've got to wire up the individual cells. But
right.
So I'll know next week if you want to call me at my regular office number.
Okay.
I'd be glad to update you. I would say probably Wednesday or later I'll have a pretty good beat on what we've got available.
Yeah.
So
those Chrysler Pacifica batteries, I guess they pack quite a punch in a small package.
They do.
From what I've read.
They do. And I've used them for testing cars and been pretty impressed with them. And the folks we've sold them to have come back wanting more. So that's always a good sign. And this guy, independent of us, has been buying used ones out on the West Coast. We're selling new ones for about the same price.
Yeah.
So, which are around $250, $275 a module.
Right.
Which is a fairly cheap date.
Right.
So. The only,
okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Yeah, we battery talk with Tom. Sorry, we'll just keep going. The company is extraordinarily well known in electric car circles, and the guy has been, he said, I want to just make sure these are good. I said, they're not used. I said, they're not used. They're brand new. They're in crates. And we've got crates of them. So, and I've been quite impressed with them. The only thing we don't have is the battery management system. But that is something that if somebody is savvy enough to be working on an electric car, they can set that up themselves. Or you could do it without one. You just have to know what you're looking at. Our phone number is 1-800-966-1039. We got a bunch of texts here. Let's see. I'm ignoring the text. Do I think Purple Heart is good for knife handles? Yes. Is it brittle? I don't know. I think it is. I've not worked it yet. excuse me. And I think I said last week, a lot of what I thought was Purple Heart might be some other Brazilian wood. And it's rough sawn, so it looks weathered, and I just haven't had a chance to pull it all together. So my goal is to get it down and together so I can see what I've got for all the folks who did ask about it. Tom, we've got a screened-in porch off the dining room, which is open below to the ground by a daylight basement entrance. I'm thinking of insulating the screened-in porch and putting some type of storm windows in. Question, would you recommend insulate the floor of the garage currently as five-quarter decking? Yes. Ideal if when you think about a floor, the heat is space up above, right? Okay, what happens with heat? If you heat that space, all the heat rises to the ceiling. So the floor will always stay cold if it's not insulated. If you insulate it, it's much it'll stay much warmer. And ideally, if it's an indoor space, it says a daylight basement, so. I would just do fiberglass. If you really want to bump it up a notch, fiberglass in and put a layer of foam over the bottom of the floor joists, and you'll have a very good, effective, insulated space. Let's see. Congratulations on my new – where am I here? Use metal cutting blade and four Oh, this is for my garage door. You have to, some, you know, this is the message. I'll read it verbatim. Use metal cutting blade and 4.5-inch grinder. Lennox makes one with diamond edge, lasts forever. You can use it for all sorts of things. Yes, I know. What I'm going to do, though, is I have a shear that we use for cutting sheet metal for when we make tanks, and I'll probably use that as opposed to a cutting it. I'm dangerous when it comes to a metal cutting blade. I have been known to cut things that I shouldn't cut. So let's see. Samson Boat on YouTube is rebuilding an old boat and using Purple Heart for extremely large keel. Okay. Thank you. Row of blocks on top of my foundation. Should I fill them with something? That's a good question. The short answer is no. The longer answer is I would want to protect them from moisture. So if they're above grade, I would at least be painting them. If they're below grade, I would cover them with some foam just to help keep moisture off of them and keep them warmer. You can insulate them above grade, but it gets a little bit more of a hassle to do. And as long as they're shedding water and are somewhat sealed from water, moisture, they'll tend to stand up okay. I have my house is on an old rock mortar basement wall, and part of it was replaced with block. Part of it was buttressed with poured concrete. I'm always looking at the block to see if there's any cracking at the mortar seams, and there's none. But it's what I'm looking at is above grade. So below grade, excuse me, has been waterproofed, and hopefully that's adequate. Let's see. We're going to take a break here. Somebody asked about the Irish Rovers. I got you one. You know, I try. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute. Okay, we're back. Yes. It's 9:19. It's hot and cold. Saturday morning. Good morning again. It's phone number is 1-800-966-1039. The text line is 601-207-4478. Got to love this one, huh? Washboard Rhythm Aces, 1931. Great cut. And caller number one, there we go. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Good morning, Tom.
Hey.
I heard you talk a couple of weeks ago that in a previous life you had had a contract to rebuild tankless water heaters.
Yes.
And I've been struggling with one. It's a 10-year-old. It's a Rinnai built and sold under another name.
Mm.
But all of a sudden, it stopped heating water, and I kind of figured out that it was a flow problem.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at it, and when I popped the hot water the overheat relief mm-hmm. to dump it, that would fire the unit, like it wasn't getting enough water through it. So,
yep.
So I flushed it because I figured it could be a flush problem. I took out the little screen in it that had been dirty. I cleaned that. Mm-hmm. I thought that would fix it. It didn't. I flushed it with vinegar, like they tell you to do, frontwards and backwards, and that didn't work. So I ended up getting some ice machine flush, and I flushed it with that, thinking that would fix it, and it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, if I run another tap, like if I'm in the shower, mm-hmm. and I won't get enough water because it won't fire the unit. But if I turn the sink on, which will give it more flow, it'll fire the unit as designed. So right. I thought it might be the flow sensor.
Yes.
So I ordered one of those from Rinnai and I installed it, and I'm still at the same problem. And I said, well, if you've been rebuilding them, maybe you've had this problem before, you could shed some light, because I'm about ready to throw it out.
Well, that's unfortunate. The units we rebuilt were non-electronic, so they were
okay.
A little bit different animal, but you've done all the right things, and it obviously is flow related. Can you get in when you replace the flow sensor?
Mm-hmm.
Can you inspect either side of that, see if there's any crud that's built up in there? Because obviously it's flow related.
I couldn't position myself, manipulate myself to look up inside.
Mm.
Of course, on the other side of it is the water source side, which appears to be clear. The only one little caveat to that is when I went to flush it originally with vinegar,
mm.
I couldn't flush it forward. It was an obstruction.
Mm-hmm.
I flushed it backwards, and it worked.
Okay.
And that made me think that there might be something tinkling around inside there.
They told you to use vinegar?
Come out in the bucket.
They told.
I did see some black scaly sand.
Yeah.
That ended up in my bucket. I used a clean white bucket so I could see.
Yeah.
And I flushed it overnight one time. It didn't work, so I just left it on overnight, let it flush all, you know, for 10 hours or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're
on the right track. I think you're dealing with obstruction in the heat exchanger itself. And vinegar is a fairly benign flushing agent in the sense that it won't do a lot of damage. It's very, very tricky to flush a coil because you can go too far and then you may not come back from that. But I think that's where the issue lays. And at this point, if you're thinking about throwing it out, you might want to get online and see about, I think muriatic acid is what's normally used by professionals. I mean, worst case, you're going to ruin the heat exchanger. But at this point, if you're thinking of tossing the thing, it may not be. Did they give a, is there an aftermarket price for a replacement heat exchanger?
I haven't gone that far down that road.
I'm afraid it's probably as much as putting in a new unit, which would make sense to replace the unit at that point.
That's what it kind of looked at. I've got a friend of mine that works for a plumbing and heating company, mm-hmm. and he suggested just to sectionalize my water flow problem before it hits the heater, that I would come right off of my pressure tank with a hose from the washer mm-hmm. and go right into the input, you know, the maintenance input drain
mm-hmm.
from the bottom of that.
Yeah.
And so that would be water coming right out of the well, because we do have a, you know, a filter in our water softener system that could have an obstruction in it.
But it has worked before.
It did for a while. Yeah, okay. I mean, it did for...
Yeah, I would try that. I mean, you know, there's two things I would try. First, I would go to the say bathtub, and open and get a 5 gallon bucket, and open the tub tap all the way, the hot water tap, and measure the flow, time it. So you got a 5 gallon bucket, you know it's going to take. I don't know if it takes a minute to fill the 5 gallon bucket, you've got a 5 gallon per minute flow. So you can do that math. That's easy enough to do. Then I would do what your friend suggested, which is bypass all the cold water plumbing, feed directly into the that faucet, and do the same, and just see if it fires. And then you could also measure the flow rate. I suspect though that it's within the unit itself, but that would eliminate everything before the unit being a problem, because it could it is possible you're having a problem. Just with water flow, not related to the water heater. So I would certainly do that before I got acid and started screwing around, because that's a nasty process.
Well, I did end up with some, like I mentioned, commercial ice makers. They have a solution, a flush solution,
mm-hmm.
which is for potable water.
Yeah.
And that's quite aggressive as well. And I did buy that at $70 a gallon.
Wow.
It's highly concentrated thing.
Is it muriatic acid, or do you know what it is?
I don't have it in front of me. I don't.
Okay.
I still have. I mean, I only needed 5 ounces because of its concentration. So
yep.
If you ever need any, but I might try that again too. I mean, I flushed it forwards and backwards with that solution, and I didn't really get any more than I did with the vinegar out of it.
Okay. Well, I would do the flow test first and check it before, and then.
Sure.
Rejigger the temporarily with a hose directly from the well pump and see where that puts you in terms of flow and if the unit fires. And that,
and if it's the same, we know it's the unit. It's
yep.
pointing towards the unit anyway.
That's right.
Okay.
Yep.
That's a great idea. I appreciate
okay.
your help.
Okay. Good luck. Bye bye. You know, the original units that we had worked on were a little different. There was no electronics in them. The most electronic part was a thermocouple. Traditional piece of hardware that is just a bimetallic probe that goes in the standing pilot. This had a standing pilot. As long as that pilot's on, the valve would be operable. If the pilot went out, everything shuts off so it doesn't leak gas. But those units had similar heat exchangers, so they could still have that same problem. But the water flow when the tap was opened worked on a rubber diaphragm about two and a half inches in diameter. So it would push this diaphragm up. In the middle of the diaphragm was a metal disc, and in the center of the metal disc was a little push rod that would open the gas valve. And it was occasionally the diaphragms would fail, and you'd replace those. That was about, well, there were other things. There was overheat switches and stuff, and it was and the units were made in France, and there were a bunch of them made over in Europe, but the ones we had were from France, and they had a vans that would go around the country, and when somebody had a unit fail, the van would pull up, have all the parts. I had all the parts at the time. We were rebuilding them, so we could rebuild them. And there was thermostatic controls, and everything was non-electronic. They were reasonably reliable. The Renais, the Norits, all these electronic units are extremely reliable and are much better in the sense you can use them as boilers if you needed to, which is what I was trying to do at the time. We did use them as water heaters as well, but you could use the newer ones very effectively as boilers for space heating if you had to, for a cheap backup. And I would suggest also, if you're looking at one of these units, look at the other two Japanese brands, which are Takagi and Noritz. They are cheaper than the Renai. I won't say they're better or worse. It's just a less expensive option if it comes to that. Hopefully it won't. And I think I think it might just need another flushing. That's my theory. I'm sticking to it. Let's see. We're going to hit that one there. We're going to go over. We got more Irish music. I haven't given up yet. It's hot and cold on Saturday morning, St. Patrick's Day Eve. Get the red paint out, boys and girls. We only got a little over 12 hours to go. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Sorry. I was out in the hall talking to Mike Dow. And anyway. Okay. That's the Rumjacks. You know, what is it with Irish music? You either have this, okay, or you have this. Is it, maybe it's men and women? Maybe the women are the lispy, not lispy, the wispy kind of music, very ethereal, and the men are the let's go have a fight. Testosterone poisoning. Is that what it is? I hope not. Anyway, let's see. We got phone calls at 1-800-966-1039 at 9:35 in the morning. There we go. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine. Hello?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to tell Tom, the last caller, about the tankless shower. Check the shower head and make sure it's not clogged, because a flow issue could be in the shower head.
Yep.
And possibly the spindle in the shower valve. If it's not floating back and forth from hot to cold on a pressure,
yep,
it could cause a bad flow.
Good point. Thank you. I think he said it was all fixtures, though, until he lifted the pressure relief valve, then it was okay. But, yeah, that's why I said use, a bathtub faucet. If a shower head usually is flow restricted anyway, and I believe, I could be wrong, but I believe these units fire at something like a half gallon per minute, which is pretty low flow. I think if you were taking a shower with a half gallon a minute, you'd be a little bit upset, because it's not a lot of water coming out. Most really low flow shower heads are something like a gallon a minute, but. But the acid test is go to the tub faucet, turn it on. There's usually no flow restriction there. If there is, he's going to measure it by having the 5-gallon bucket. And Dick, years ago, when he and I would be doing heating systems and stuff, he always wanted flow meters in systems so we could measure. We knew exactly what was happening immediately. And as I have continue to carry the gauntlet in terms of working with any kind of heating device, I would get on eBay and buy what are relatively cheap, I'll call it an analog flow meter, and it's just a weighted metal thingy in a clear plastic tube that's graduated and tells you what the flow is just by the sake of the water going by it. And I have one on my pellet boiler at home. I have one at the pellet boiler at work. I've got them on the shelf. And I go on eBay and buy them because you can pick them up used because people, they never wear out. They never break. Sometimes they discolor a little bit, but you see that, and they're like 10, 15 bucks. Now, my friends who are technologically advanced, more so than myself, will buy ultrasonic flow meters and all this electronic stuff, which is all well and good, but the Luddite version, the weighted metal thing, they always work, you know, and they give you reasonably accurate results. So, but in lieu of all of that, when you're a homeowner and you're having to do this, and I've done this many times when I've not had a flow meter on site and I'm dealing with domestic hot water things or domestic cold water things, a 5-gallon bucket and an iPhone or a phone with a timer or a wrist, use that wristwatch too, will get you the same result. And pretty, and you can just run it 3-4 times to make sure you're accurate. And there you are. Back to the phones we go, line two. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
I have a 50-gallon hot water heater, electric hot water heater.
Mm-hmm.
It has a heating element in the middle and a heating element at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Both are thermostat control.
Yep.
My question, should there be a different setting between the top or the middle element and the bottom element? Or should they both be the same setting? And question two, mm-hmm. What would be the most economical temperature for me to run my electric hot water heater?
Good questions. The second one is easy, as low as possible.
Okay.
until somebody hollers at you. But I would say 150. See, you really don't want to be much. There's a couple of trade-offs here in terms of electric water heaters, and this holds kind of true for most water heaters. An electric tank water heater has some interesting things going for it. To answer your question, the most efficient would be as low a temperature as you could tolerate. That might be 110, 115 degrees. The trade-off in doing that is you can breed bacteria in the tank. So and Legionnaires is the one that is everybody knows about. And if you're constantly flushing the tank, you're using water all the time, it's not as big a deal. But if it has to sit for a while at that lower temperature, it has the potential to breed. I mean, that's a great, maybe not too high for bacteria to say, oh, this is wonderful. So the public health folks like to see it be more like 140. Well, that's kind of unrealistic. It's not real healthy for the tank itself in terms of longevity to run it hotter. Things are going to tend to break down a little bit quicker. So I guess the happy medium is maybe 120 or so and trying to balance against the potential health problem, which doesn't seem to be a big issue. In terms of you've got a big tank there. So if you normally the upper element would be a little bit warmer, the lower element would be a little bit cooler. If you're running out of hot water with just the upper element up and the lower element down, you can turn the lower element up higher and get a full 55 gallons of hot water. Whereas if you, for sake of discussion, if the lower element's turned all the way down, the upper element's turned wherever you want it to be, you've got 27.5 gallons of hot water. And what happens in an electric water heater, in any tank water heater, is you're bringing in, say, 40-degree water. It pools right down at the bottom of that tank. And the hot water stays up at the top. And they stay very well segregated from each other until you're just about ready to run out. Turbulence kind of mixes it up. But if you measure the temperatures in a tank, which, you know, was 4 or 5 feet tall, you get very good stratification. So the very top can stay hot. And we did a lot of testing with this. Bangor Hydroelectric had done a lot of testing years ago. They had a lab where they were doing this, where they were working on electric rates for heating tanks up at nighttime and not using any electricity during the day. So we were making a tank that we heated to 180 degrees every night, and then it was 120 gallon tank, excuse me. And they would put it in this environmental chamber, which could be different temperatures for testing, and they would draw hot water out of that tank. Well, if you're heating a 120 gallon tank to 180 degrees Fahrenheit, you may be able to extract 200 gallons of usable hot water from that tank. If you're using more than 200 gallons worth of hot water a day, maybe you need a different water heater. That's a lot of hot water. But was something we did and they did. But what we found was that it could be 150 at the very top, 6 inches of that tank, and be 40 degrees at the bottom. It's a 4 foot deep tank, not very deep. So, and it was very pronounced the way it stratified. So I hope that helps. I got kind of technical there at the end. Let's see. Let's go over to line one. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Yes. On that Renai call you had, the first one, I've had two or three of these, and it almost always turned out being the heat exchanger. Mm-hmm. And recently my brother did one. He took the heat exchanger out, bought 5 gallons of vinegar, soaked it overnight, or maybe two nights, I'm not sure. The amount of minerals that were in the bottom of that bucket would blow your mind.
Mm. Yeah, that's what I'm agreeing with you. I think that's what the issue is here.
Okay.
So, thank you. Bye bye.
All right. Bye.
Yeah. You can do it quicker with more aggressive chemicals. I'll be honest. I don't think I've ever done one. And I have. You know, we made copper heat exchangers for, oh God, probably 30 years for our tanks. And we dealt with enough corrosion issues from groundwater, not from acid, but just from groundwater. And what would the nearest I understood what was happening is the pH of the groundwater can go from acid to basic. It kind of flip-flops, goes back and forth. And copper doesn't like that. The copper will fail. And copper's a pretty noble metal. It does not corrode easily. But, probably over 30 years, probably we've dealt with a dozen domestic hot water heat exchangers that have failed. And it was always domestic hot water. It was never space heat exchangers, with one or two exceptions where the tank had some kind of issue going on. We had customers who had tanks that were not ours that used the EPDM rubber. And when that breaks down, it attacks copper from the outside. But that's a whole different thing. There's organic chemicals in there taking place. But from a pH point of view, which is what we're talking about, when we're flushing a coil out, we've got a copper coil. We're putting an acid in there trying to break down the minerals that are built up that react when acid's put on them and come out like the caller just described. But if you're not careful or you don't know what you're doing or don't have the experience, maybe that's a better way to describe it because it is an experience thing, you can really damage the copper. And that's why I never tried to do it. I know I could be very ham-fisted very easily. Oh, that's a dial tone. We don't need that one. Let's see. We got a text here. Let's get rid of that thing there. And some of my copper pipes are green. I have two different instances where copper will start leaking in the middle of the pipe through a pinhole. What chemical is causing this in the water? I would get your water pH test. Well, I would get a water test done. You can either have it done from the state or Northeast Labs in, is it Fairfield, Winslow, somewhere around there, to see what's going on. And maybe the water is slightly acidic. If it is, that would be my first guess from what you're describing. You've got to get it being neutral, at least neutral, if not slightly basic, or it will continue to be a problem. And I've seen it happen here in Maine a lot. It's just we have sometimes water can be kind of aggressive in terms of the groundwater, the chemistry, the minerals that pass through, and you do not want acidic water. Take it from me. You're going to have a pinhole like this text person here. I had a customer/friend lived on the southern tip of Verona Island, and they knew they had a water issue, and they had I know they had iron in the water. I know they had a softener system as well. And the we had put a solar hot water system in, and they called me and said, we don't have enough hot water. Something's not right. So I go and check, and I turn on the tap. I get hot water, but I'm shut off the tap, and I'm standing there next to the tank, and I hear this very, very subtle hissing noise. What is that? So the building was built on a slab, but there was a crawl space underneath where the tank was. So I went under there to look at the plumbing, and there was water spraying everywhere. There were so many pinholes, and all the pipes, of course, were green. To make it more fun, the cats thought that was a great place to use as a litter box. So it was all wet, all green, hot water, and cat droppings. And all the copper hot water pipes, I think we did cold water pipes too, it was mostly the hot water pipes let go. And I offered my services, and I replumbed with plastic. And the problem went, well, what happened was somebody had hit the bypass on the iron system, and apparently everything fell apart at that point. So, well, what do we got here from Tom up in Sangerville? Maybe spring will come after all. Yes, there's a glimmer of hope here. For some reason, where my shop is, it's paved, and the only place there's ice is right by my doors, and I think that ice has gone out today. So. And I, as I said, I will have the ice out of my, the ice is out of my shop. And not many people can say that about the building they work in, that you've got, the ice has gone. But it's really kind of fun to finally see the floor starting to dry. And I took images with my thermal imaging camera to see where the pipes were. And I think, and I hate to admit this, but I have to just because in full disclosure, if you think that there's anyone out there who doesn't make mistakes, it certainly is not me. That's a triple negative, I think. There's 7 loops of radiant floor. And I labeled all 7 loops when I put them in. And I'm not sure what happened, but I think the last 2 loops I put in, something got mixed up because I'm not getting circulation through them. And I know they're not frozen because there was nothing in the pipes. I had manifolded them off early on. I think I've got to undo 4 connections, and it's a pretty simple diagnostic thing that you do. You cut the 4 pipes in this case, because it's 2 loops, I think, that are mixed up, and you just blow on the pipe, put a little pressure on the pipe, and the mating pipe will have flow come out of it, either air or in this case, antifreeze. And so that's a diagnostic that I learned the hard way, because I hate to say this, I've done it before. It's not the end of the world. We can fix it. Good morning. You're on the Voice Maine.
Good morning, Tom.
Hi.
Have you heard about the new, I think it's Lexus or one of those companies, going to be putting out a horizontally opposed engine where it's 2 crankshafts, the pistons face each other. There's no head. It's going to be a 2-stroke engine. And they're looking at thermal efficiencies of close to 50% versus like 30% for a regular automobile engine, because there's no head that you have to cool, and you're not wasting your energy trying to cool off a head.
I'm not. Who was doing this?
I think it's either like Infiniti or Lexus is working on coming marketing that pretty soon.
No, I haven't seen it, but I'll have to see if I can find something.
Yeah, if you Google that, you'll see in the distance face each other, there's two cranks.
Hmm.
And then it illuminates the head so you don't have that heat loss, so it increases the efficiency of the engine just by that.
Interesting. I'll have to look it up. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, bye-bye. I just kind of lost it here. I just got a text message. Somebody saw a robin in Newburgh. I get up early in the morning and I usually sit on the sofa and I'm looking at email and stuff going on. And I'm sitting there looking out the window and I see what appeared to be a hawk landing in an apple tree. And I'm sitting there looking at it and just kind of watching. And it's looking around and it's moving its head back and forth. I realize that's not a hawk, it's an owl. And I got up to see if I'd get to a camera and take a picture, and of course it flew off. But I've been told that there's an owl that is around my property. I've never seen it up till this week. So I guess that's a sign of something. I suspect the owl is hungry, and there's been too much snow on the ground for the to get at the critters that owls usually get at. So it was just one of those things, I guess. Let's see. You know, we're almost out of time this week, and I haven't found Francis Albert here to get us ready to head out of the show, and because I've just been on this kick for Irish music all day, but there we go, we're ready now because we're just about out of time. So next week, we are gaining on the move. I think two things are going on. Well, we've got a lot of interesting cars coming in, so if you're interested, we'll be kicking around today till 3. But also, we're going to have what is going to probably be a pretty big garage sale once I get stuff out of there. There's a lot of stuff I'm just not going to move. I'm just going to sell it. Because if you think that there's something screwy that I've discussed that might be on the shop floor, by all means, give us a pay attention, because we'll be having that sale within the next 30 days. Oh, boy. Spring is here. See you next week. Happy St. Patrick's Day, too, to all you Irish folks out there and wannabes.